Hello and welcome to In Conversation, where my guest today is David Swain. David, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
You work in the ambulance service, you're a committed church member, but you, sitting here, look a very reserved kind of individual. But you go out and do mad and crazy things, parachute jumps and that kind of thing.
Yes, I've been involved with two parachute jumps, actually. I've always had a very keen interest in aviation. And the first parachute jump was actually associated with the ambulance service. Now, there was a programme called Blue Peter, which you're probably aware of.
It's been going children's programme on the
around
BBC.
For years. Yes. And they were doing fundraising for hospital monitors, paediatric monitors of some sort. I can't quite remember what it was. But I thought that was an ideal opportunity for raising funds and also to realise one of my ambitions, which was to do a parachute jump. So we got a group of about six or so on the station locally, started going around recruiting, trying to raise money from various hospitals. And as we went around, we found that I wasn't the only one that wanted to do a parachute jump, and we ended up with about 25. We had nurses, firemen, police, support staff from the ambulance service. And then we went up to Peterborough Parachute Centre one very cold February, did our 2 days training, and on the morning of the jump, on this particular occasion, it was one of those lovely, crisp, clear days. I think it was -2 on the ground.
So slightly less up there.
Yes, for every 1,000 feet you go up, you knock off another 2 degrees. So I think it was about -6 when you jumped out. And I remember all the noise and commotion, all the excitement. You're sat on the side of the aircraft, leap out, and then all of a sudden silence. It was absolutely marvellous.
And a great adrenaline rush.
Oh, it was. And then, you know, you could hear the birds below you. You have a bit of time to enjoy it, and then all of a sudden, of course, you think all that ground down there is very hard. It's -2. Prepare for your landing, and it all worked to plan.
And you did that for charity.
Yeah.
But the charity, I suspect at the beginning, was maybe the secondary thing. It was the excitement that you were looking for.
I have to confess that probably was the case, yes.
Now, how does that come out of somebody that looks a fairly conservative, fairly staid fellow? Why do you need these kind of rushes?
Well, I've always believed in living life to the full. Any experience that's offered to me, then I've gone for. I try not to turn anything away.
And we'll look at some of those experiences, because you've travelled with humanitarian aid in various parts of Europe and out as far as India, and we'll come to that in the story. But you're actually, you were born less than a mile from the studio where we're filming now in Watford. What kind of family was it that you grew up in?
It was a Christian family. My parents, I'm the last of four. I have two sisters that both live in Northern Ireland, Miriam and Esther.
So you're the spoiled brat.
Some might say. And I have a brother, Michael, who's close by as well. We all went to a Christian school, private education. That was very important to my family. When I think back now, that must have been so difficult. Four private educations to pay for on two people that worked in a factory. But never once did I ever hear them. Now I look back, they never ever mentioned any complaints about, you know, you should be grateful for this, that and the other.
Because they believed that the Christian education, that they ethos did. was very yeah. important.
Yeah. And I think, looking back now, that gave us all a stable start to life.
And that side of your life has simply been stable the whole way through.
I think that was the foundation, yeah.
So you're not one of these people that had a Damascus Road experience or a great rebellion and ran away from home?
No, none of that.
But you got involved in the church quite early. You went to the school until you were age 16. And actually at school, this is where you're a traditionalist, isn't it? It's at school where you found your love.
That's right. I was 16, and on a carefully engineered manoeuvre, I approached this girl that had just come back from Australia. She was 5 foot and half an inch. Her name was Caroline Rhodes.
I caught her at the dining room and asked her if she would like to come with me to the Valentine's party. And she did, and we went to the Valentine's party, which, from memory, was actually just a film. And it was in the days when you got to a scene where there was kissing, they used to...
blank the screen.
Well, not quite blank, but they blurred it. So, of course, you can imagine the usual moans and groans that go on something like that. But, yes, that was the beginning, and 35 years later, she's still 5 foot and half an inch, but she's changed her name. It's now Caroline Sween.
So 35 years of bliss, because you got married very young, actually, didn't you?
I did. I was married at the age of 20, and Caroline was 19. And I know a lot of people at the time thought that was quite young, but we just knew that that was right for us.
Yeah, statistically, you've defied the odds.
We have, yeah.
But that's wonderful. And of course, as you left school, I guess you left school at 16.
I did.
And yes. And what was the career plan? You had some great scheme in mind?
Well, I went to Cassio College, first of all, for a two-year course in bakery organisation and practice. And there, I seemed to... everything seemed to come natural for some reason. Well, I probably struggled a little bit at school. But once I'd left, I started winning all these trophies, and in fact I left as Bakery Student of the Year, so that was quite an interesting time.
So we should really be seeing you on the television at the moment as a master chef producing these wonderful breads and cakes and so on.
If I decided to stay in that career, then who knows, you never know, yeah.
So why didn't you? If you were winning all these awards, and then I think you even got employment straight afterwards as a baker.
In fact, I was offered, immediately my course had finished, one of the part-time tutors took me up to show me a bakery in a flat in, I think it was Northampton. And I would have been running two bakeries and had the flat to go with it, had I taken the job. But it would have involved me working on a Saturday, which I wasn't prepared to do. So
that would have clashed with your faith.
Yes. Yeah. So I had to turn that down. But when I think back now, I was 18. I just finished college, and all of a sudden I was offered this job of running two bakeries. So although I didn't think about it at the time, it was actually probably quite an honour.
Indeed, yes. And could have been quite a successful career for you. But instead you moved off in another direction and looked towards the ambulance service. What made that choice in your life?
Well, I'd worked for 1 year in industry, getting to work at 6:30 every morning. Not that that's a problem, because I'm used to getting up early anyway in the ambulance service. But after a year, I thought, this isn't for me. And I saw an advert in the paper for ambulance staff in the Watford area. Went along for an interview, did a quick drive in an ambulance, and got put on the course.
Is that all it took in those days?
It was. Well, yes. When I think back, and what's involved now in joining the ambulance service is obviously completely different to then. But yes, that was it. It was all done and dusted in half an hour.
So that's again now been your career for many years. What's the joy and satisfaction in that kind of job?
Well, it's very rewarding because obviously anybody who's helping anybody in any way in their life, you know, you get a sort of buzz from that, I guess. And I do it all the time, not for self gratification or anything like that, but it's just always nice to help people anyway.
There's a lot of time kind of sitting around and doing nothing, though, isn't there?
Oh, no.
Don't you see? I mean, we see ambulances just parked up on the hard shoulder and, you know, having their coffee break and thinking, well, there'll be an accident sometime.
I think you've got a very wrong idea of the way the ambulance service works now. In the past, it was a little bit more relaxed, but now the demands are tremendous. There's very little downtime. Just occasionally on nights there might be a couple of hours or something, but even that's rare now. You usually find that you're working all the way through.
So there's a constant pressure there.
Oh, yes.
But a reward, because you're finding yourself helping people.
Yes.
And helping people has actually become part of your life in so many ways, hasn't it? Because if we come back to the charity, and starting off with the parachute jump, you've then started getting involved in other projects? First of all, with Pathfinders, with young people, kind of scouts, and taking them off to foreign lands. How did that come about?
Well, when I joined the Pathfinders, it was being run by Lynn Dyson, an Australian, who was very charismatic and very keen to do exciting things with the children. And Albania, just, which was our first trip, had just opened up to the world, literally within the last year. And I went with Lynn and one other on a trip to Albania to see if we could find a project that the Pathfinders could do.
So what age group of children are we talking about?
Well, normally, I mean, the age group runs from about 10, 11, 12, something like that, up to late teens. But this sort of trip wasn't for the really young ones.
No,
this was really for the older ones.
So this would be 16, 17-year-olds?
Yes, although we did have some that were younger than that.
And you were taking them into Albania just after the collapse of the regime and it opened up to the West. Really,
yes.
Crazy place to take teenagers.
Well, yes, and I think that was viewed by others as well at the time. When we went on our fact-seeking trip, we looked at several projects, and the one that we decided on in the end was in a town called Rishen, which is probably about 2 hours' drive from Tirana, the capital. And we found a hospital that was in dreadful state of repair and a school next to it. So we were going to do a joint project there. Obviously, with a group of Pathfinders, it's very limited to what you can do, but there was something there that we could do.
So what actually did you achieve?
Well, when we finally went out with the group, we had about 25, and we had this big 50-seater coach. So that allowed us to bring in lots of supplies. We bought all our own decorating equipment. We also bought in quite a few supplies from Watford General, which is the local hospital. They gave us quite a bit of equipment as well. So we had this coach full to the brim.
And in the hospital, we're more or less just decorating the rooms. But, I mean, I think back now, I remember taking some video at the time. There was this sink that was just broken and there was water pouring out of it constantly. I remember seeing somebody in this big room with an oxygen cylinder next to them that clearly didn't have long to live. Nobody in there, flies everywhere. Another room where there was patients sat by the side of their beds all smoking. It was just amazing.
Having a different world.
Having seen how we are over here, obviously in hospital life, it was just so totally different.
And that made a difference to the teenagers experiencing that.
I think so, yeah.
David, when you went there, you were all going as volunteers, but that wasn't in their vocabulary at all.
No, they couldn't understand the whole concept. Everybody who did anything in Albania always got paid for it. And we started cleaning up and decorating these rooms. And a lot of the staff, including the doctors, wanted to join us and help us, but they just assumed they were going to get paid, so they were a bit concerned as to who was actually going to pay them.
How did you work through that?
Well, we tried to explain, you know, that we weren't being paid and they weren't going to be paid. And actually, in the end, they did join us, quite enthusiastically, but of course there was no payment and they realised there'd be no payment. So maybe we taught them a new word.
Little learning curve there. I mean, that idea of volunteerism is important to you, isn't it? Because you've got your full-time work that you do as an ambulance staff. You work quite hard in your local church as well, back then with Pathfinders and now in terms of the audiovisual that you look after, and yet you keep going off on these trips as well. What's the motivation behind that kind of volunteerism?
Well, it's a tremendous opportunity to you as an individual, and you're helping others as well, of course. But I think for you to be able to experience what's going on around the world, it's all very well watching it on TV, and you do get a very good picture these days of what is going on around the world. But to actually be there and to experience these things firsthand, it's very rewarding.
But if you just push that a little bit further, that's the career you're in anyway. You're a paramedic. A crisis happens, you're there in the nightclub or you're there at the road accident. Aren't you doing your bits in your paid employment?
I don't think you can get enough, really. It's I just enjoy doing it.
Okay, let's take you on your next trip then, because you did Albania and you obviously caught a bug of some kind, because the next year you found yourself again in a new country, Lithuania, again with a group of young people. Even more crazy, again, the Berlin Wall had just come down and you make your way in there. Tell me about that trip.
That's right. The Soviet Union was falling apart, and as you say, the Berlin Wall had just come down. That was our first stop, actually, on our way. We stopped in Berlin overnight. We all went to the wall, took our little souvenirs. Then we went to Poland, and we had a camp there for a weekend with about another 1,000 Poles, and then headed off up to Lithuania.
And actually took some of the Polish youth with you to Lithuania.
Yeah.
What were you doing there?
There we were redecorating and doing some repairs to a school.
How did they react? You're going in there with your Western ideas and values into a newly opened communist country where they're not used to the kind of freedoms you're used to. Mm. Wasn't there a massive kind of culture clash and what are you doing here kind of thing?
We never found any of that. The Poles were able to communicate better than us, so they were really our ambassadors. But I just remember driving into Lithuania about 5 o'clock in the morning when we arrived, and it was still half light. And there was all these road sweepers out with their little witches' brooms. It was so much activity going on. It was just so different to what we're used to back home.
You obviously decided that the adrenaline rush wasn't high enough, because the next thing that then happened, in a sense, was the Balkans crisis. And you thought, hey, let's go there as well, and ended up going to Kosovo.
There's a great lady, Dr. Elaine, and she had this charity called SOS Bosnia, which was probably several years old now, obviously during the Bosnian crisis that she was involved with, runs to and from there. And I was invited to join her and two others from the London Ambulance Service, taking out a lorry load of medicines and also a mobile surgical unit, which she had purchased from a hospital that was closing down nearby. This surgical unit was absolutely superb. It had probably never been used, one of these great NHS things that they buy and then never used, but we took that to Albania. But of course that was designed to be used on good roads over here. Now the roads in Albania and some of the treks that we took were very challenging.
You're saying very challenging. That sounds a very discreet kind of word to use. Tell me a little bit about the journey.
Well, we got interrupted on our way up to Shkodra by a battle going on in the village, and we could hear all the gunshots, so we had to divert down this track along with all the other traffic. But it's one of these roads that once you start, there's no turning around or coming back, because it's fields either side, very muddy, and we'd had a lot of rain. And then we had to go over this very tiny bridge, which we didn't think was going to take the weight, but there's only one way to find out, because as I say, there was no going back, and that was over you go, which we successfully did. And then the trickiest part was probably going over the mountains from Shkodra, which is all bandit country. So we had to set off very early in the morning, about 5:30, something like that, just before we got light. And you're going over these sheer drops. I remember trying not to look down as you're driving. But we successfully got through.
And the equipment all arrived and was successfully used. And you got a lift back by helicopter, so you got a nice reward at the end of it.
Yeah, I mean, the camp, nothing really prepares you for seeing something like that. As we got closer to where we were going to, you'd start seeing the tractors, loads and loads of tractors, with people on the back with all their possessions leaving the area. But to see this at first hand and talk to the people as best you can, it's very humbling.
Because, of course, at that time we were all watching it on the television, but to be in there actually doing something, what does that do to you, to your heart, and maybe what does it do to your faith?
Well, you see a lot of evil in this world, and that's a classic example of it. But you also see the other side. There were so many different organisations there offering help. So when you balance the two, you realise that there is a lot of good in mankind, and it's nice to see that side of it.
Now, you did trips after that, and in one of them you actually had to kind of turn round, didn't you, because there was bombing going on.
That's right. It was probably about a year or so after that. This time it was going to the opposite, so this was going to Serbia. And we got as far as Munich, and then the coalition forces started bombing, so we thought, well, it's probably not wise. So we had to turn back, and about 3 months later, we successfully managed to get into Serbia.
And had your success, and that was working with the psychiatric hospital?
That was two. We took two complete dental units that had been refurbished over here. We left those in Belgrade, and then we went south to a mental hospital, yes.
You spent this time in Europe. You worked as a volunteer, in that sense, through the Balkans crisis, and things settled down there. You can't stop, though, can you? You've then made a leap and gone outside of Europe, and these days you seem to have quite an interest down in India. How did that come about?
Yes, there's a gentleman called Kish Podder who you've interviewed before on this programme. He has been working with children for nearly the last decade in India, and I went on one of his projects, Stop India. Stop stands for Save the Orphans, Please. And that was involved with building an accommodation block. It was part of an already existing orphanage, but again, part of the world I'd never seen. India's a fascinating place. I've done three projects there now, and on the second project I took my wife Caroline and my son Carl, and whilst we were there, Carl developed a relationship, and then later on this year we were going out for a wedding.
It's a dangerous thing to take your children on projects.
It is, isn't it?
So you're going to have an Indian daughter-in-law?
I am.
That's why you say India is such a fascinating place, maybe. But coming from, you know, from Watford, from England, and spending the time working there and developing the relationships with the communities there, do you think what you're doing has made a real impact, or would it be better just to take the money and let them do it?
That's an argument that's often used, and yes, you could argue that if you wish, but the thing is, it's not about that. It's about you personally going to experience these things. Yes, what we do out there, others could do, you could pay them to do it, but it's as much for you as it is for the individuals. And also, would people be giving their money anyway to these projects? I think once you've got a project like this, it spurs you on. You know, you find the money, you go out there and do the work.
Because there is that big argument, isn't there, that you know, your airfare out there would probably pay the salary for a labourer for a couple of years.
Yes, if you went along and asked those people, are you actually going to donate this airfare, then they never would.
So it's a satisfying thing that you're doing. You feel you're achieving something. You see a difference in the lives of those children, those orphans that you're working with. You carry on working back at home, though, don't you? Quite apart from the ambulance service, you're quite involved with your local church. What are you doing there?
In 1999, I was head deacon for a while. I wanted a new challenge, so I took over the audiovisual unit, which at the time was just a PA system in our church, which has about 400 membership. Having played around with video for a while, I wanted to see if we could start recording our services and distributing them on video. So I had a new digital camera at the time, and I had an old VHS camera. So with those two cameras and a little vision mixer, we started to produce videos. And I sold the idea to the church board, and we managed to get four cameras and buy a vision mixer, and that's how we started.
Is that making a difference in the ministry of the church?
We did have a big boost to this some years ago, because obviously it's on a very limited budget and these things can swallow up money. And there was a family member who happened to see us in the church recording these one day, and his mother had recently died, and she would have wanted to have left money for the church, but she hadn't in her will. So he was offering 10% of her estate, and he wanted to find some specific project. And having seen what we were doing, he knows how his mother would have benefited from having these videos at home. So we had a large financial boost to our project.
And I've recognised personally, because I recognised that when you preach at your church, that's the last time you preach that sermon, because the message seems to go out all across the British Isles, and wherever you turn up they say, oh, Victor, yeah, I saw you on that Stanborough Park video.
It's amazing where these go. I mean, we still do videos, but mainly DVDs now, obviously for the better quality, but one goes off somewhere and it gets passed on, which of course is great, that's the whole idea.
And it doesn't stop the link with the young people either, because they're the ones that now have a role in church, they're running the cameras and the system.
That's right, we have to have a minimum of six at the moment, because you've got three camera operators, one which we have on the remote, a sound engineer, and then a vision mixer, and then an assistant.
Do you think that's important for the young people? It gives them the role that maybe they would otherwise just slide out.
I think so. It's you know, it's interesting, and it seems to work so far.
David, you live a very full life, and you know, ambulance service, the skydiving, the trips, the videos, and everything. What's the thing that really motivates you, that keeps you going, that makes you look to the future?
I see an awful lot of evil in this world, both in my work and on these trips around Europe. And then I see the opposite. I see the goodness in people. And I think that is what makes me go on. There is an awful lot of nice, good people out there. And I think that's a huge motivator for me.
David, thank you so much for talking to us.